Hey folks, Sam Jones here. Welcome to another edition of Off Camera, the show where I get to talk to iconic, creative, curious artists and find out how they got that way. And in this episode, I sit down with actor Chris Messina. You know, if things turn out differently, Chris Messina might have been the next Baryshnikov. But growing up, the other kids in his small Long Island town wouldn't let him dance without a fight. And the ensuing nickname, Ballerina Boy, and other more graphic homophobic slurs followed him around for most of his adolescence, as did a subsequent persistent questioning of his own identity. By the time Chris was asked to be in his high school's rendition of the musical Pippin, he almost didn't do it. As he explains, "I was so scared to be in the musical and scared to show people my dancing because I got beat up so much for it. But I remember going to school the day after my performance, and it felt like I was finally seen." After that experience, Chris fell in love with the hard work of the craft. He dropped out of college to pursue acting full-time, and after a brief stint trying to be Jack Kerouac, he started winning roles in the theater and playing dark, complicated characters. In his mind, he was on his way to becoming his heroes, or anti-heroes, more accurately, like De Niro, Hackman, Walken, and Duvall. But then movies and TV happened, and Chris found himself with a, quote, nice guy problem. A series of roles in rom-coms like Julia and Julia and Vicky Cristina Barcelona, and his multi-season work on The Mindy Project, was taking him, in his mind, further from the mean streets of his acting dreams. And the simple fact is, Chris has the ability to disappear into any role he is offered, nefarious, noble-hearted, or otherwise. But for an actor who tends to question everything, Chris wondered if he saw himself differently than Hollywood did. Then along came Sharp Objects, director Jean-Marc Vallée's dark and disturbing discourse on family dysfunction, murder, and self-harm. Chris landed the part of the out-of-town detective and turned in a performance that is equal parts subtle, dirty, and so realistic that you could swear he wasn't acting. Which, as he explains, he barely was. And for Chris, who longs to get inside the engine and get dirty, it was an experience that changed his whole approach to acting. Chris joins Off Camera to talk about feeling like an outsider, living a real-life actor's nightmare, and about the benefits of watching Chinatown over and over and over again. So pull up a chair and listen in. Hi, Chris.
Hey, Sam.
Thanks for doing this.
Thanks for having me.
You know, you show up in a lot of films and TV shows that I just naturally gravitate towards, and I feel like I've known you for a long time because of that, and I think you're one of those guys that is always going to be a real human being on film.
Well, thank you for saying that. Yeah, I guess that's the job, you know, to disappear, I guess, and while bringing as much as you can of yourself to the part. You know, when I was in New York, I did all these great plays with these really complex characters, and I really wanted to disappear, you know.
Right.
You know, maybe that was me, you know, running from myself, or that's, you know, what I thought acting was. I was looking at guys like Gary Oldman, and you know, they were chameleons.
Yeah.
So it was something that I aspired to do. For someone to watch something I did and you know, forget it was me.
Well, when I think of Gary Oldman, I think of more extreme characters sometimes, you know, like Sid and Nancy, or some evil villains, or exactly. But I think what you managed to do is there's a bit of an everyman quality in the disappearing. And I think that shows up in Sharp Objects, which we should say is on HBO, and it's you and Amy Adams and
Patricia Clarkson.
Yeah. And it's the story of these terrible, dark murders of teenage girls in this small town in Missouri. And you play a detective from out of town. And it's one of those performances where I feel like you're not doing any tricks, and yet you're completely disappearing into who that guy is. And
nice.
And it's a compelling show because Jean-Marc Vallée, the director, I think has created something that's completely unique in terms of the way he uses memory and flashback in quick little bites. And it's just an unconventional approach to storytelling. And I wondered if it was unconventional on the side of making it as well.
Yeah, he's a master, and his visual language is really, really fascinating. He was one of the It's very unusual way of working, and actually very frustrating way of working, because there's no lights, there's no marks on the ground, there's no rehearsal, and there weren't a lot of takes.
Is that a budget thing? I mean, it seems like HBO has money. Yeah. They could have some lights.
He's confident, but ultimately his way of working was very freeing, and something I... After that job was done and I was on another set, I longed for his way of working. I think he made us all better. I think he tries to get the actors to stop acting. And I think I did this movie with Sidney Pollack. It was the last movie he acted in. It's, you know, I'm crapping it, but I got to hang out with Sidney Pollack, and I bothered him the entire time, and he was probably annoyed by this young actor, you know, asking him questions about Tootsie or whatever. But eventually, he was stuck with me on this rooftop, and he couldn't get away. And he said something along the lines of, "With a theater performance, the actor is weaning himself off the director." Creating a performance. And on film, the actor has to rehearse every time they call action on film, and the director will put together the performance. You don't give a performance, you just rehearse it. You're just finding the character each time, and then the director puts together what becomes a performance. I bring that up because, in a way, that's what Jean-Marc Vallée does. There wasn't a lot of discussion. There wasn't rehearsals. We would go in and play.
Did it throw you off at first in terms of your own security about knowing your job or knowing your craft or feeling like you were good?
Yeah, always. Yeah. Yeah. Feeling like I'm good definitely is, or good enough is definitely something that plagues me, and you probably heard that a lot sitting in this room with actors.
Yeah, I mean, I just wondered how when you come up to someone who's totally unconventional like that, if it throws away your like if it ungrounds you.
It does, and I think it does in a way that's probably beneficial to the work, and I think that's part of his process. But yeah, ultimately it was scary. But you know, the great thing about acting is you get to pop into all these different kinds of philosophies, these different kinds of way of working. It shakes you up, but Jean-Marc Vallée was in ways similar, because I like the rawness. I like not the no marks. I like being sloppy.
It's funny, it's like you're describing a paradox of acting, because, you know what I mean? Like, there's all sorts of ways to get to good work. But I'm wondering if what an actor often needs is some sort of method for getting out of their own way.
Mm. I think like when you're talking about, you know, Daniel Day-Lewis and, you know, all these greats, De Niro, Meryl Streep, and we talked about Gary Oldman, you know, I think they can do it. And then they can get there and forget it all and get out of their own way. I mean, I struggle with all of that, you know, every time I go to work, you know, and still trying to, and maybe till the day I die, trying to figure that out. And honestly, that's the most fun of it, really, for me. Not even the doing of it or the watching it, but the process and the I'm just an acting dork. I'm just like I'm a fan. So the process of the same question you ask fascinates the fuck out of me.
Right, right.
You know, just how the fuck do you do it? And everybody will give you a different answer. And it's all, nothing's right or wrong. It's very individual. But how you get out of your way, I guess, is a major factor in it. You know?
So when you're on set, how do you quiet the critical voice in your head that says, like, I don't know if I matched this to the last take?
This is a struggle of mine, but getting rid of like any kind of people pleasing is huge for me. Because I auditioned for Sharp Objects. Amy Adams called me. She's a friend. We did Julie and Julie, and she called and said, "Hey, I'm doing this. Read the book." I read the book. She said, he doesn't know you, Jean-Marc Vallée. Will you come read? Absolutely, want to do it. And we read, and she was extremely available, present. She wanted me to get the job. He wasn't sold on me after I left. It wasn't a done deal for him, for whatever reason. Eventually, he came around. And so when I was there, it took me 2 episodes, possibly 3, to stop when they'd call cut, to go, is that okay? Is that, you know, right. Should we do it again? Maybe I should do it, you know. And then when and my work probably suffered. It wasn't as fun. I probably wasn't as dropped in. I probably wasn't as honest. And then when I start going, you know what, fuck it. I have the fucking job. I don't think you could fire me at this point. I'm going to stop.
Right, 2 episodes. They can't. Yeah. They can't refill all my parts.
Exactly. I'm past these 2. We're well into 3. They're not going to get rid of me. And then I was like, fuck it. So. And then you know what? I was more free. It was more fun. I think he probably liked me better. And we developed a friendship, him and I, and a way of working. So I say not giving a fuck because you know I felt that in the theater a lot too. That I would. I felt the difference in the theater where you go to the audience, you know, you just come out wanting them to like you. Where's the laugh on that line? You know, do you see me? Do you get this character?
And you're needing something. Mm-hmm. And if it doesn't happen, that affects your mindset right then.
I think the audience and the director and the camera can feel that. Maybe even now with this interview, you know, the difference of, and then the difference of just sitting back and going, you know, This is me, for better or for worse. This is me, and this is what I'm doing right now.
What did you learn about yourself through that, you know, through not being comfortable?
I think using it was the, because it fit that character. The character in Sharp Objects he's out of town, he's alone, he's not wanted in this town. He wants to prove himself as a detective. This is a possible big case. So anytime I felt Jean-Marc was still questioning hiring me or I don't understand where the fuck, where's the camera? what are we shooting right now? I used it. You know,
or that's what being present is, really. Like, that's all you have, right?
Yeah, I think so. It's the moment. It's what's actually going on.
Right.
So, yeah, that was. I mean, look. Sharp Objects for me was a. It's a massive highlight of my career thus far. Because it's a return to the what I was talking about earlier. Those. You know, not so much in the character I'm playing, but the piece, a complicated story. The plays I did were darker, like, you know, in the vein of Sharp Objects. And then to sit across from Amy Adams and Patricia Clarkson and Elizabeth Perkins and Matt Craven and watch these really incredible actors work was a treat. And then, you know, trying to steal or understand Jean-Marc Vallée's process. You know, I go to all these sets really and I just try to steal. You know, it's the same way I'm going to steal from you, you know, and these, you said that these cameras run how long?
Listen, don't steal the cameras because then we won't be able to make
a
show.
Exactly. You have enough of them. I could probably take one. But like these reds that you're using, you know?
Well, I think as long as you can talk, they can go.
That's what I like.
We should see.
Yeah.
We'll just keep going until
people will be
either
sleeping,
you fall over or the cameras stop running.
So, yeah, I like being a traveling Wilbury to all these different sets. And I go, I like that. I like that. I like that. Right. I don't like that.
Well, speaking of stealing, I read that you watched Chinatown kind of on a loop during making this. And it made me wonder, what do you learn about acting from doing something like that? And why was it necessary to do it on this?
That's a hard movie to watch over and over because it's so good that it's hard to see how they did it. Usually when it's not so great, I can decipher what's not working about it. or what I want it to be or what I think it could be.
Right.
But Chinatown's so good on every aspect. You really have to watch it over and over, I think, because most movies I pop out of because I'm always dissecting it. And that's a movie that I get sucked into.
So you were trying to watch the performance and figure out how it's done.
Yeah, I was, you know, I really did, I loved the movie. I mean, I'm not alone there, obviously, but and I love Jack Nicholson. So it was something that I loved to begin with. I did watch as much detective stuff as I could. He's a private investigator in that, but any kind of cop I looked at just to see what are the cliches and what will I probably fall into, what shouldn't I fall into, what should I fall into, and how does this differ.
But it's interesting for me to hear that there's still a research process that goes into knowing the history of the kind of character you're playing.
Sam Rockwell taught me that. We'll talk about a scene and then sometimes he'll say, oh, that's, you know what you should watch? You should watch this scene in The Deer Hunter, and he'll turn me on to something that just will, it's not about copying it, it's just inspiring you, you know, and going, oh, there's a moment like this in Raging Bull you should look at, you know.
I always wonder how much that of that work is done so that when you walk on the set, you have a comfort level, because we don't ever need to know your backstory in Sharp Objects. And yet, if you hadn't have done that work, I don't think the audience can sense that there's this full complex life that this person's leading. Mm. Like, is there a place where you know, okay, now I'm ready?
Yeah. I mean, I always, I didn't do very well in school. I barely got by. And
it's because you were watching Chinatown.
I was just watching Chinatown over and over, trying to figure out how and why.
Everyone else was prepping for the SAT.
Exactly. I did really bad in school, and we had a great, I grew up in Long Island, we had a great English credit called Living Theater, and we all got together and did these plays about sex, drugs, and rock and roll. They were all improvs that we created. It was super progressive for high school, and it turned me on in a huge way to this life. At some point, because I used to dance when I was a kid, and my mom was a dance teacher, and I wanted to be Baryshnikov, and I did it from like third grade to ninth grade. I got beat up I was like the Karate Kid meets Billy Elliot without the talent or the karate, you know? by my senior year, I think, of high school, they said, oh, you can dance, you know, you want to do the school musical. And I said, no, I can't do the school. It was Pippin. I said, I can't do the school musical. They said, no, I said, I can't sing and I don't want to dance. No, but you can dance and we've seen you in these little plays, you know. So I did it. And I'm sure in hindsight I was horrible, you know, but I worked my ass off on it because I was so scared of it. Scared to be in the musical. I was scared to show people my dancing because I got my ass kicked so much for it. I couldn't sing. And I remember showing up the day after the performance and some of those teachers that really thought it was pretty clear that I was going to do nothing saw me.
For the first time.
Yeah.
Right.
And from that moment on, I was like, oh, you got to work your ass. Like, so the only way I can come to any set now or any job, even any audition, is I have to do a lot of work just to be okay.
You do?
Just to be okay.
You're like, if I just walk in and be me, that's not going to be enough.
Yeah, that's it. Maybe that's just hearing that out loud makes me sad. But but yes, I have to look at it from as many angles as I can, talk to a million people about it, rehearse it with six different acting coaches, have a long conversation with Sam Rockwell.
Watch Chinatown.
Watch Chinatown seven more times. And then maybe I could enter in, you know.
And then you're like, this Kellogg's cereal tastes great.
Yeah, caught.
I want to pick up on something you said in terms of something, you know, when you were talking about Sharp Objects, and you kept mentioning that this character was an outsider and you knew something about being an outsider. Mm. And I wonder if that related to dance, I wonder if that related to to being a kid who was doing something that maybe especially even more back then was going to put you in that category of you're going to get bullied or you're going to get made fun of? Or,
yeah.
Like, is that when you felt like an outsider first?
Yeah, probably. Probably. I've always, maybe we all do, you know, but I've always felt like I was describing this to my buddy the other day, that I kind of go back and forth where I have so much gratitude for my life and my career. And then I flip that seconds later to, you know, extreme anger or desire for something else, something more. I often feel like I'm watching a bunch of people build an engine of a car, and they're greasy and they're a mess and they're having fun and they're all getting dirty. And then I often feel like I'm watching them from some kind of sideline close by. I feel like that often in my career, that I haven't yet gotten dirty enough. Does
really?
That make sense?
Like, you're almost there.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
I feel like that often. And maybe that's just me, but certainly when you grow up in Long Island, you know, it was, you know, ballerina boy, and they didn't understand that you wore tights, and, you know, I'd walk down the hallway and I'd have to get in the fights, you know.
And you were the only one at your school that was sort of singled out for that.
Yeah. Yeah, my mom was a dance teacher, and I was bouncing around the house to, I loved Grease. We had a VHS of Grease. I loved John Travolta in it. And I said I wanted to take karate, and she's like, what do you think about dance? And I was like, yeah, that sounds great. And I went, and I loved it. One of the reasons I wasn't, you know, paying attention in school. It was from the third grade to the ninth grade. When I went into high school, I stopped. I wanted to go to LaGuardia High School for dance. I wanted to be in fame.
Oh, the fame school.
Yeah, I wanted to be, you know, I wanted to live forever, fame, you know. And my parents didn't want me to do that, and I was like, you know, you're fucking ruining my life, you know.
Oh, so you were that serious.
I really wanted to be Baryshnikov. I mean, I hadn't, you know, in hindsight, there was no way, in fame or no fame, that was, I was never going to become Baryshnikov. But I really loved it. And I'm glad they made me go to public school because, you know, I met some of my greatest friends from there, and this guy, John Gavrilek, this theater teacher, changed my life.
Right. How did the, before you quit or when it was the toughest, you know, in terms of being mistreated at school, how did that kind of affect your own self-image?
Yeah, it made me question, because they kept telling me I was gay, and they kept telling me I was, you know, not a part of this community, you know? So I didn't know who I was or what I was, you know? I thought like, oh, I'm ballerina boy, oh, I'm gay. Not that that would have been bad, it would have been fucking great. But at the time as a kid, it was confusing. Like, I guess I dance and this is not accepted, or you know, I had no idea what really gay was or what, you know, I wore tights, that meant I was a girl. Why is that bad? Why is it? It was confusing.
Right.
You know?
Would you bring that home and talk about it, or?
No. No, I think they knew I was getting my ass kicked, but I don't think they knew the extent of which I was, like, you know, just kind of contemplating who I was. I'm like every kid does, you know.
Yeah.
Kids can be, you know, no news here. Kids can be mean, you know.
Yeah.
And but it was also great. It gave me strength. And I was like, so what if I'm fucking gay? So what if I wear tights? So what if I, you know, I'm fuck you. I'm doing. I hung in there, and I guess. Maybe I would have left it anyway, because I fell in love with acting. I would have found my way out. Maybe I left it earlier than I, you know, because of them being so fucking brutal about it. But it made me, you know, it made me strong. So I, you know, I'm glad I had to struggle with that. I don't resent any of that, you know, or feel bad about it. I'm happy that I...
Right. Do you think that that made things like improv and auditions that much easier?
Yeah, it was early. It was an early beatdown. So by the time I got into the Kellogg's commercial audition, I was like, you know, you can't fucking hurt me.
Yeah.
You know, I've been taking blows.
I think there's something to that. I think that it creates a different mindset towards like going out and getting
struggle
something.
Is good.
Yeah.
You know, stride. I think so. I'd like that for my boys. I'd like them, you know, you want to see your loved ones, you know, climb to their heights but if everything comes just easy to you, I mean, any kind of struggle that I've gone through to this day, that feeling I'm telling you about sitting outside watching, you know, everybody work on the car and me wanting to get dirty with them, I think it just makes us, right? It makes us who we are.
I wonder if you were like actively searching for something that replaced that or gave you an identity. You know what I mean?
Yeah, in school I was like always, I was always fascinated with other people, you know, and I always wanted to, you know, I'd spend like a week or two on one person and then kind of dress like them or act like them or talk like them, and then I get fascinated with somebody else. I'm not sure if that's common or, you know, but it felt like I was, you know.
Oh, that's fascinating. So you were kind of becoming characters and studying mannerisms and wardrobe. And
yeah.
That's really interesting.
It was, at the time it didn't feel, it just felt like I didn't know who I was and what I, how I wanted to be perceived, I guess.
Hey folks, Sam Jones here. I want to take a minute and talk to you about Helix Sleep. Now, I don't know when the last time was you took a quiz to communicate your sleeping preferences, but I'm guessing the answer is never. Well, Helix Sleep believes there's nobody on the planet like you. So why would you buy a generic mattress built for everyone else? Their whole thing is, let's find out about you and build you the perfect mattress. Which is a great idea, and it's an idea I wish I'd thought of. They created a sleep quiz that takes 2 minutes to complete, and then they use the answers to match your body type and sleep preferences to the perfect mattress. Whether you're a side sleeper, hot sleeper, you like a soft, or a firm, or a plush bed, with Helix, there's no more guessing or confusion. Just go to helixsleep.com/offcamera, take their 2-minute sleep quiz, and they'll match you to a mattress that will give you the best sleep of your life. And for couples, wink, wink, nudge, nudge, say no more. Helix can even split the mattress down the middle, providing individual support needs and feel preferences for each side. So now for the first time, you can get a good night's sleep, even if you have a partner that flops around like a fish on the deck of a boat. And they have a 10-year warranty, and the best thing of all, you get to try it for 100 nights, risk-free. So that's like over 3 months of finding out whether you like this thing or not. It's pretty cool. Right now, Helix is offering up to $125 off of all mattress orders if you go to helixsleep.com/offcamera. That's $125 off your mattress order if you go to helixsleep.com/offcamera. So take the quiz, order your mattress now, and in a few nights, you can find out what you have been missing your whole life, which is a great night's sleep. One more time, that's helixsleep.com/offcamera. And now, back to the show.
So tell me about going to college and dropping out after one semester and going to New York to start auditioning.
Yeah.
How did you sort of reconcile that idea of I want to be my own identity of an actor and figure out this business and then seeing it sort of put in your face? Like a million people wanted to do the same thing.
Yeah. Well, going to college, I went to Marymount Manhattan College. I got a theater scholarship, which was great. But I went there and it was really shocking and annoying to be around all these kids that were like the best actors in their high school, you know, and they were all singing and dancing in the hall and talking about headshots, and it just was fucking annoying. It made me not want to do it at all.
What was it in your head that distinguished you from all of them?
I thought I was, at that point, I thought I was cooler than all of them. You know, I thought I was, I had moved from that, and stopped teasing me that I wear tights until, like, you know, I had smoked some pot and I had found beer, and I was like, I found the strong island of the Long Island, if that makes any sense. And so I was like, you guys are a bunch of, you know, narcissistic fucks, and I don't want to be a part of this. I probably was the same fucking thing, to be honest with you, but it's...
They were probably thinking the same thing.
Yeah. And maybe I was just playing, that was the character that I had showed up in. This, you know, I'm better than this, or I'm tougher than this, or I'm cooler than this. So it wasn't for me, you know, and I went back to my parents' house on Long Island, and I worked on a lobster boat, and I...
You did? So you actually, like, left New York for a while.
Yeah, I was like, I don't want to do this.
So what were you going to do?
I wanted to be Jack Kerouac, so that's the next character I wanted to play. I wanted to go on the road with a buddy of mine. We bought a Volkswagen bus.
So you didn't want to be a writer, you just wanted to be Jack Kerouac.
Yeah, exactly. I didn't want to do the work. I just wanted to play the part. Yeah, I wanted to see the country, and like, I guess I was still trying to find, you know, who the hell I was. Where I grew up in Northport, it's a beautiful town. We're actually famous for Jack Kerouac spending the latter part of his life there. His mom lived there, and there was a bar called Gunther's Fisherman Bar. People come in and get hammered there.
So yeah. you had Jack Kerouac and that romantic idea out your front doorstep.
Yeah, there's something in the water where I grew up in Northport where there's something special. There's something creative in that water. A lot of people came out of my high school and went into the arts, and you know.
And it sounds like you were dying for some like authentic experience of.
Yeah.
You don't even know what it was,
yeah.
But you wanted to live it. And
yeah.
There's all different reasons, obviously, why people become anything, but especially actors. You know, there are people who want the fame.
Yeah.
And there's people who want the, you know, the attention and. And I'm curious if you wanted the life as much as you wanted. Like, when you think of those guys that you liked in the 70s, Hackman, De Niro, Pacino, you know, Robert Duvall.
Hoffman.
Did you romanticize the lives that they had as much as the work that they did?
It's been the whole spectrum.
Yeah.
You know? I think why you started and maybe why you continue it changes, perhaps. Or at least it did for me. I think there was a part of it that felt when I did that play Pippin, that I was seen and I was heard and I was somebody. I think there's a part of it that, you know, probably when I was younger, romanticized about, you know, being famous and being liked, being adored.
And that may be reactionary to the experience you had being, being ridiculed.
Yeah, like I'll show you, you know.
Right.
You know, ballerina boy's gonna do something, right? And I then think you study and you learn a respect for acting.
Right.
And you start to get inside of the intricacies of the craft, and you learn how beautiful it is and how vast it is and how special it is. And I think then it starts to be like this image of the people working on the engine. You just want to get dirty. You just want to get in there and get filthy and get raw. I mean, I watched I don't know how often you guys go to the Arrow Theater.
I love the Arrow Theater.
The Deer Hunter was just there, and I went. It's those actors at their peak. Cazal at his peak, Streep, De Niro. Chris Walken is stunning. And so I left the theater really high. This is such an extraordinary film. And then I got really depressed.
Because of course, the cycle of an artist.
Yeah. It's like, I'm not going to do that. I haven't done that. They don't make those kind of films anymore. And if they do, they don't want me to be in them. very hard to be in them. And I thought, that work, I mean, you're watching the scene, the Russian roulette scene.
Yeah.
And I read that and heard stories. It's like 4 a.m. De Niro wants this. It's 4 a.m. They're really slapping the shit out of each other. There's rats. They're wet. It sounds fucking amazing to me.
They're in the engine. They're dirty.
They're in the engine.
Yeah.
Yeah. You're right. They're dirty. That to me is, and it doesn't have to be, a scene of Russian roulette, but you want your heart in the Russian roulette. That's the reason I'm in the game, to get in the fucking engine and get dirty. So when you do, when you watch Sharp Objects and see the work that's done in there by Amy Adams and Patricia Clarkson, dirty. It's raw, it's beautiful, it's complicated, they're incredible.
Well, I don't know if you give yourself enough credit, because your performance in there is raw and it's dirty. And I mean, gosh, there's a scene in Sharp Objects which is one of the most graphic things I've ever seen in a film that's not a porn.
Yeah,
you know what I mean? In terms of, and you know, it's fully graphic and revealing and intimate and vulnerable.
No, thanks. Yeah, it is, and it was vulnerable. And it's fun to live on that fucking edge. It's really fun to push to push the crew, to push the actors, to push yourself, and to push an audience. It's like, I find that really fucking fun to push.
Yeah.
You know, but I just, you know, I'm longing to for more of that. And you know, ultimately, I left the Deer Hunter high, then low, and then I went high again because I felt like, after discussing it with some people and batting my head against the wall, I thought, well, it's up to me. I could try to make, you know, I direct films. I want to direct more. You know, we could still keep trying to do it. You know, I could give myself the engine.
It makes me wonder if you can describe why your heroes are your heroes. What is the unifying reason that it's a great performance to you?
It's a great question. Maybe it's the, you know, we're talking about transformations at the top of this conversation, and that stuff is beautiful. But maybe it's when somebody can bring their own blood to it. And maybe those performances are, you know, whether they had a hump or a limp or whatever, an accent. Maybe those performances that stand out to us is when their own blood is pumping and the camera picks that up, you know, it's in the character. I don't know. Does that make any sense?
Yeah. Yeah. I think the reason I fell in love with movies was because when I was first allowed to go see a movie by myself without my parents or ride my bike to the theater, I would occasionally have these experiences where you'd go in when it was daylight, you'd go to like a 4 o'clock show, and you'd be transformed by the film, and then you'd come back outside and it would be dark.
Yeah.
And it was this strange feeling of like, it's almost like you say you get high after the Deer Hunter, and you walk around and all of a sudden you have this heightened sense of life that you didn't have walking in, and you want to be the hero of your own story so bad.
Yeah, it's amazing.
Yeah.
Incredible. I got into my Volkswagen after the Deer Hunter and I thought I was Michael. I thought I was De Niro's character. Just the way I sat into the car, you know. Just the way he was so cool and tough and such a badass. I thought, you know, and then by the time I got like 2 blocks away, you know,
sinking back into Chris Messina.
I was like, I'm not. But yeah, it's incredible, that feeling. That it can take you away.
Yeah.
Yeah, I remember as a kid leaving the movie theaters and my parents driving and being in the back seat and like looking out the window like and feeling like the movie was still happening in me, you know, like there was a camera and I was still in that movie, I was still in that experience. It's that feeling that you described is magic.
Yeah.
So I think it's that, and I think it's not wanting to be Chris. And I think it's wanting really desperately to be Chris. And I think all those things combined. I said to a buddy of mine the other day, I said, why the hell do we still all do this? You know, why are the, you see these actors that were really good and really pushing themselves. But why the fuck do we keep coming back to this? Because it's brutal, you know? What makes us want this, you know? I don't have, there's nowhere that this is going because I don't.
I was waiting for the answer.
there's nowhere that where this ends, really.
That is the answer, is that you don't have the answer.
I guess where we got to in it was there's a certain thing that happens from action to cut where you get lost. You can. It doesn't always happen. But where you can get lost and you get into that magic. I think that addiction to that magic is maybe the reason why we keep coming back for more, you know.
Now, I know you've mentioned that you thought you had a nice guy problem for a while.
Yeah.
In terms of, you were very successful at being nice guys on,
yeah,
on film and getting,
yeah,
those roles. And it made me curious about, as a guy who wants to soak in the Deer Hunter.
Yeah.
And then, you know, after a string of roles where you're wearing blue button-down Oxfords and...
Yeah, lots of those.
And you got, yeah, sensible hair and...
Yeah.
you know what I mean? Did it ever make you insecure about, maybe I see myself different than the business sees me?
Yeah.
Or maybe the business is trying to tell me that I'm not the actor that I am in my head?
Totally. Still to the driving here this morning, I was wrestling with that. I mean, yeah. For sure, you know, I did these delinquents in the theater, and then Alan Ball cast me in 6 Feet Under, and I did the last 6 episodes, and people really dug that show, and I was a Republican lawyer, and my friends back in New York thought that was funny.
Right.
But Hollywood, if you do something halfway decent, then there you are again. It's a struggle, I think, that most actors have. And maybe all different art forms. I mean, Dylan played the electric guitar, and they booed and they were pissed off. They wanted the acoustic, right?
And I would think for an actor that's incredibly limiting feeling, and yet you have agents and all those people who also, they want you to work.
Yeah.
So it becomes, I think of all the art forms, it's the hardest one to control where your career goes.
It really is, yeah. You and I think you get a lot of frustrated actors because we are often have such little control, you know, and then you get to a set and someone says, stand here and wear this, and that's your prop, and, you know, then get up on that line, you know. So that's one of the reasons why I started directing. I think it was less about, like, I have to tell this story, and less about, like, I'm a filmmaker. And I think it was more about, I have a way of working that I enjoy, and I have a hard time finding that way of working, so I'm going to do it myself and set up a dance floor, so to speak.
Right.
For my philosophy. And if anybody thinks that's a halfway decent philosophy, please come join me.
It would be hard, though, to not constantly wonder how to control this thing and how to move it towards,
yeah,
where you want it to go.
Yeah, when you stop and you just listen and you become a little more at ease with just what is and stop fighting what is, it's more pleasant. It's,
yeah,
more enjoyable. And then that ego creeps in and tells you what isn't.
Right. Like, what will non-actors never understand about acting and about that lifestyle?
The amount of no's, really, the amount of no's is devastating, you know. And it's comical. It's you know, all my friends right now that are driving all over town with, like, different shirts in their car because they're going to that audition, and they put,
right,
on that shirt, and then they drive over there, and then they put on the T-shirt, and they get the trucker hat, and then they take the trucker hat off. And those are the lucky ones. Because I have a plethora of people that would love to drive over all over town, but they fucking can't get an agent.
They would love to have to buy a trucker hat.
Yeah,
and keep
they
it
want to get. They want to put all their, you know, outfits in their car and drive around, but nobody will let them do that. So, and I'm super lucky. I'm sitting here with you in this rad studio.
White room.
Yeah, this that Kubrick-esque
will let you out of eventually,
room.
Maybe.
No, I like it. I like chatting because I'm starting to figure some shit out about myself, so it's good.
I would hate all the no's and I would hate all the insecurity of being an actor, but I would love the idea that my job here is to let my mind wander and contemplate.
Yeah.
And
it's gorgeous.
Isn't that living the life of an artist?
It's incredible.
Yeah.
I'm writing a script right now. Nobody's waiting for it. Nobody's expecting it. And I'm not a writer, but I'm dabbling in it. And it's very hard, very frustrating. And also, it's super fun. And I bring it up because I have all the time in the world to just cut and try it again and think and take a walk and come back to it. And I like time. I like time when I'm shooting, and going back to Jean-Marc Vallée and two takes, and it's, I walk away going, there's so much more we can explore here. There's so much more. He saw what he needed. He moved on. He's the boss. Some actors really want to go home. I love my home and I love my family, but I want to do it again. To me, time is beautiful.
It brings up something that I think Woody Allen said. There's a story about him directing and the actor asked what was wanted here in the scene, and I think he said, why don't you try one happy, yeah, one sad, and one indifferent, because I don't know how I'm going to use it until I get in the edit room. And first off, what a concept to have that much confidence to tell an actor, just give me the menu.
Yeah.
And I'll figure it out later.
Incredible.
But also, it's what you're talking about of no one really knows anything, because there's obviously a million ways to tell a story. And I wondered how it changed your whole perspective on acting.
Awesome. I think every actor should go out and direct a short film if that's what they have to do, whatever that may be, because I think you learn to appreciate and respect and understand all the jobs, the sound, the lights, the props, and you also get an insight into acting, and that, going back to what Sidney Pollack said, you're rehearsing, and so you just fascinating to see the process from that point of view. It made me definitely want to direct more.
Right. Well, it is interesting because you realize the power of editing, and I think that any actor who gets a chance to get in on that realizes how different their job is than what they think it is on the day.
Yeah.
I think probably actors are trying to control a performance based upon how they've read the script and the movie they have in their head.
Yeah.
The director has a different movie in his head and may have another movie in her head when she edits it.
Yeah.
It's a crazy thing.
That's why trust is so important. Because if I trust you, you're the director, and I trust you, I could... I don't, there have been performances or films that I've done where I didn't have that trust and I was very wary about what I gave. And so you're reserving. Does that make sense? You're reserving,
yeah,
what I'm giving you. But if I trust you, I'll give you that scene that you talked about in Sharp Objects and be that vulnerable and be that open and be that graphic or raw. And I trust that you'll do the best job with it.
It sounds like the thing an actor has the most control over is really choosing what jobs to say yes to and what to say no to.
That's it.
And what directors to work with. And
that's it.
Your film, Alex of Venice, did something so smart that I loved. In it, Don Johnson plays a man who's dealing with the onset of Alzheimer's disease, and you made him an actor in the film, and he can't keep his lines in his head because this disease is coming on.
Mm.
And it made me wonder if there's a certain, nightmarish quality to creating that scene. If that's a common thing for actors, this fear that you'll be in theater and you can't remember your lines,
okay,
and you'll freeze up and you'll have stage fright, and then amplified by this disease. But just the fear of being on stage and
not knowing either, yeah, where you are or who you are.
That's the big nightmare.
That is a massive nightmare. I had... On the newsroom, the worst I was sweating like Albert Brooks in broadcast news.
Yeah.
I had a long, in fact, I was preparing to direct the movie. And of course there was so much to prepare and it was very new for me. And they had that job, I wasn't a regular on the newsroom. So they called whenever the character was, they had new material and they'd have to see if I was available.
Right.
And they called for the finale. And I remember I said to my wife, like, I can't do this. I can't. And again, I was telling you, I need to work really hard to just be okay, you know?
Right.
And we were like in auditions and we were prepping and she said, just call them and tell them they'll get it, you know?
So you actually were contemplating not even doing the job or because you didn't have that time to get
comfortable. Yeah, the finale of it.
Right,
yeah.
Right.
And every episode's a pain in the ass and it's hard and I have to work my ass off. So they call for the finale. I say, I almost don't do it. But I want to be liked, I want to be a hero, and I do it. And I get there, and I'm in the bullpen in front of the entire cast. Jane Fonda's there, Marcia Gay Harding's there, Jeff, Emily. And I don't think I said the lines right once the entire day. They were coming over and putting, like, calming cream on my hands. It was a nightmare. It was the actor's nightmare. It definitely... scared the hell out of me. And it was super embarrassing.
Really? So you had just sort of a meltdown.
It was a nightmare. Everybody was beautiful. At some point, I looked at Sam Waterston and Jane Fonda, and I apologized, and I said, you know, the cameras are all set up, and I'm like, I'm sorry, I'm so fucking sorry. And Sam Waterston said, what are you sorry for? This is what the work looks like. And I was like, beautiful, beautiful, because I was in pain. And then Jane Fonda said, I fucking love you. I fucking love you. I love you right now. And she was saying whatever was going on with me, she thought was right for the character in this moment and should be kind of used, you know. They were all beautiful to me. When I showed up for the third season, and there was Jeff Daniels, who was... also always really cool to me, and he was the captain of the ship, and he knew it was a requirement on that show because he had, I think, had seen guests come in and, you know, weather the storm. So he knew this was a job where you had to rehearse it at home like a play. You know, I walked in, and he said, hey, Chris. And he said, you need an earwig today, you know? And he just busted my balls, and I was like, no, I got the cue cards set up, so they're going to come in. But it was embarrassing. It's embarrassing. It was nerve-wracking, really nerve-wracking.
I think that's such an amazing thing, because you probably were standing on the edge, the precipice I'm just going to leave.
Yeah, it was like all my nightmares were coming true. I was like, I'm allowed to play with the big boys and girls, and I'm letting them down, you know. It was really scary, and it was humiliating, you know. It took me a while to get over it, and
really,
yeah, it took me a while. And then I was like, yeah, fuck it, you know, it happens. That's just what happened.
You've got to somehow, in those moments, I would think, make it human.
When there's a catastrophe like that,
yeah.
And everybody did on the newsroom. They really did. I think they probably all felt like, thank God that's not me right now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And they've probably all been there.
And you know when you left that they were like, holy shit, I'm not even describing it as bad as it was. It was
really.
It was like, you know, you did the scene several times, and every time it was like, what's the line? And then I'd go again, and then I'm like, line? You know, it was over. It was like a fucking beating.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. It's the thing where you, like, see in the terrible movie where the actor goes like, and they're like, okay, that didn't happen, you know. Right.
But it was happening.
But it did.
Oh, my God. That's horrible.
It's easy to get nervous.
It's easy to lose all your confidence.
Yeah.
God. It makes me sort of more aware of all the of how fragile confidence can be and how the place you're looking for is vulnerability and it is open and free and not know what's going to happen next. And yet that could be waiting for you. A day like what you're describing on the newsroom could be waiting for you. And I wanted to, before we go, ask about the time you did dance on the Mindy Project. Because I read something where you said that the writers asked if there's anything else you do that they could write into the show, and you said that you were a dancer, and they wrote it in, and once they wrote it in, if I'm not mistaken, you were then terrified that you had to now go dance.
Yeah.
And I was really genuinely curious why, after having that kind of history, and then you get to actually show people that that's part of your life, why it terrified you so much.
Well, I think because dance is so exposing. And, I think you can learn a lot about a human being by the way they dance, by the way they move. And so, you know, I could sit here and pontificate about my career and what I have and don't have, what I want, what I don't want. But if I was to dance with the cameras running, I think you'd learn a lot more about me. Maybe I was afraid, that somebody was going to make fun of me again, maybe it's like some scar that was opening. But it was fun to do. In hindsight, it was really fun to do.
Yeah.
It was nerve-wracking, and it was one of those special skills, you know. I wish I said skateboarders or something.
Yeah. I race muscle cars.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly.
Why didn't you say that?
Yeah, exactly. We wrote this episode, and Danny's racing this. So, yeah, I'm grateful that they did it, because it did return me to an essence of really the origin of my love of entertainment.
Did your mom see the episode?
She did. Yeah, she's like? Always very proud of, my parents were always extremely proud of anything I did in terms of, my career. So it was pretty easy to make them happy. I'm lucky that way. But definitely dance is something that she takes pride in and feels that she lit that fire for me.
That must have been a moment for a parent to see their son on television dancing and knowing that that's where it all started.
Yeah.
That's pretty cool.
It's cool.
Listen, I gotta tell you, I could talk to you all day, and it's been really fascinating, and just enjoyed having you here. So thank you for opening up and telling me about your life.
Thanks, man. Thanks for having me.
Yeah.
Hey folks, that's our show. I hope you enjoyed diving deep into Chris Messina's psyche. I sure did. And I sure enjoyed going back and discovering some of his work that I hadn't seen before. You should definitely check out his directorial debut, Alex in Venice, which is a great film that also stars Mary Elizabeth Winstead and Don Johnson, and The Giant Mechanical Man that he did with Jenna Fischer. And then you can go back and watch The Newsroom over again to see how brilliant he is, and pay special attention to that scene he was talking about in our conversation, because it's amazing how hard an actor can be on themselves and still turn in extraordinary work like that. So enjoy your rabbit hole deep dive with Chris Messina. And when you're done doing that, take a deep dive into offcamera.com. That is our website, where you will find Chris Messina and 157 other guests that we've had on this show. When you go to the website, check out our monthly subscription. You're listening to me right now on a podcast, and I am very grateful for that. But if you haven't seen the TV show, you haven't yet experienced what it's like to see these conversations unfold in 4K black and white. And right now, for $4.99 a month, you can have access to our entire archive. You can watch these shows on any device as many times as you want. It's a great way to dive deep into the show. But that doesn't mean we don't love you listening to the podcast, too. So if you're not already a subscriber, take a minute, go to iTunes, hit subscribe, and give us a review. Anything 5 stars and above is acceptable, and it helps other people find us. So take a minute, subscribe, show us your support, and tell your friends about Off Camera. Also, you can poke around our website. We have some really cool things like digital magazines and a portrait book and some special signed items. And there's some items on there that make great gifts for your friends and for yourself. So check all that out. If you want to talk about us or talk to us on social media, we are Off Camera Show on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. And I am Sam Jones on Twitter and Sam Jones Pictures on Instagram. You can also send me an email. I am sam@offcamera.com. I want to thank everyone that helps on the show, and I also want to invite our newest member of the team, Zach Valdry. I also want to mention Crawford Shippey, Nathan Shields, Michaela Galvin, Sasha Snow, Kara Johnson, and the ubiquitous Matt Davidson, who seems to be everywhere and nowhere at once, and usually looking for a Band-Aid. We couldn't make the show without the hard work and talent of all these people, so next time you see him on the streets, just give him a hug. Except for Matt. Don't give him a hug. He'll get the wrong idea. Most importantly, make sure to tune in next time when I sit down with actress Elizabeth Olsen.
The thing that's the issue is, like, you know, you're so fortunate to complain about something like people liking your work. I don't mind if someone, like, at the grocery store, there was, like, a little boy, and he was very sweet, and I was really happy to sneak a photo with him. What I'm not cool with is a man in a tinted window car following me to my home. So I pulled over and I got out of my car and I walked straight to his car because I was so mad. I just moved. And I was like, you're not going to find out where I live, buddy.
After growing up surrounded by the circus that came with being the sister of the Olsen twins, Elizabeth was embarrassed to admit that she wanted to act for a living. In an effort to counteract the nepotism criticism, Elizabeth worked hard to prove she belonged. Her career took off after powerful performances in independent films like Martha, Marcy, May, Marlene, and Wind River. She's also taken on Marvel's Avengers franchise as superhero Scarlet Witch. Now, Elizabeth is taking on television with her most recent project, Sorry for Your Loss. Elizabeth joins me to talk about forging her own path despite her famous family ties, about how she can outshoot Mel Gibson, and why she's the most zen type A personality you will ever meet. See you next time, off camera.